Welcome to Inside Whitehall with me, James Starkey.
And me, Jonathan Gullis.
Well, welcome this week. We thought we would go inside the workings of Parliament, behind the scenes, if you were.
And the corridors of power.
The corridors of power with the talent that is Jonathan Gullis. And look back on some of the things that Jonathan and I have learnt, perhaps working in Westminster over the last kind of 5 to 10 years, about how some of the things work behind the scenes. It was brought, the idea came from looking at some of the amendments that recently had gone before Parliament and how those amendments sometimes drop because of deals with the government. And I just thought it'd be interesting to talk to you about how some of those things have gone since you become an MP, things that maybe, we've talked a lot about specific procedure, the way things are done. But we've also talked before, I think particularly with Pretty last season on legislation, about how much some of the stuff behind the scenes, the kind of tea rooms and so on that people do. So we thought we'd have a look at that today.
Well, yeah, if we have a look maybe when it comes to legislation, amendments, we've seen that in the news recently. If you look at things like the Rents Reform Bill, for example, some amendments were laid by Conservative MPs, even though they had a significant amount of signatures, I think around 50-odd signatures, they weren't actually then called by the Speaker and therefore cannot be put to a vote in the House. You look at the Rwanda ping pong that we saw one late Monday evening recently, which went back and forth between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. And again, how with Lord Brown, who is a Labour peer, a kind of deal was done, in essence, where Lord Brown was originally wanting to say that everyone who claimed and could prove that they were someone who served alongside the British Army from Afghanistan would automatically be granted the right to remain in the UK. And the government kind of gave an assurance from the dispatch box, as we call it, James, to Lord Brown, that anyone who's already over here and has applied under those terms and conditions and has ended up, can provide the evidence for it, they would be allowed. But they said they cannot allow new arrivals that same treatment because it could potentially act as a pull factor for the smuggling gangs to get people over. So, you know, that was behind the scenes late in the hours of Monday, late in the evening on Monday evening, going into Tuesday morning when Lord Brown stepped down. And it was that moment then we suddenly saw Labour peers going home, for example, some of the crossbenchers that meant the final amendment that still was lingering ending up losing the physical bodies it needed to keep getting votes in the Lords, to keep, therefore, keep sending back to the Commons, which essentially is what gave Rishi Sunak the ability to get that through Parliament. And that's been quite commonplace throughout my time in Parliament. I'm sure from your perspective, Special Advisor both in Environment, Food, Rural Affairs and obviously the Home Office, you would have had or experienced those kind of discussions behind the scenes when you're sitting down with the ministers and the Secretary of State to talk about where can compromise be found?
Yeah, totally. I think one of the things I guess you don't maybe see happens so much through the news is the consultation that happens right throughout the bill with MPs and other stakeholders. So there might be, you know, it might be the online safety bill where you're engaging with the NSPCC, or it might be the environment bill where you're engaging both with kind of MPs that have concerns about that. And MPs that are maybe looking to even assist you on things that you know is going to be tricky in Parliament. And again, some of the groups around that, whether it's farming groups or kind of Greenpeace type people, etc., you know, people that are going to have a very powerful voice as that bill goes through the different stages it goes through in Parliament. But to kind of rewind, your group of people, the 19ers, had an unusual entrance into Parliament. So you come in late
December
19, but very quickly Parliament goes into a situation that it's never been in before, where it starts to happen remotely. So I thought we'd just touch on that because some of the things I think we're going to touch on are maybe around the COVID issues, because there was a lot of consultation with MPs on COVID issues, meeting with the Prime Minister, the relevant secretaries of state. But to walk us through that, just, you come into the early bit, you come into Parliament.
Yeah.
And how long is it before you...
So from December 13th, we're elected. Most of us are in, but over by the weekend, we're down here. And then, what was it, mid-March? I'd lose track now, but mid-March, with Parliament is virtual. By then, you've had most elections or coming to the end of most elections for select committees, for example. But of course, most legislation is yet to even get off the ground. A lot of the agenda that the Conservatives won back in 2019 under Boris Johnson in terms of legislative agenda was either being consulted on or being drafted at that time. And so therefore, it meant that we weren't able to do it justice. And because ultimately what happened when we shut down Parliament is we voted to give, and I don't think there was actually a physical vote, it was just kind of accepted by all sides of the House, so it went through without a division, went through on the nod, as it's called in parliamentary terms, powers to ministers that didn't require even votes. Ministers had power to be able to do things regarding COVID without needing the House's approval. We had lots of virtual opportunities to raise questions or to give our views, both privately in briefings of all MPs across the House. So I was sat on virtual calls with Labour, Lib Dem, SNP MPs, as much as I was just my Conservative colleagues, but also was in virtually doing oral questions to departments or ministerial statements. But again, kind of hard to do the checks and balances because it was virtual and because there could have been a technical issue, we had to submit all our questions in advance.
Right.
Whereas in that is a voluntary thing. Now we're in a normal parliament. During COVID, you had to submit it in case you went, your sound went halfway through and the minister could still give the response. And I can imagine that was particularly frustrating for opposition MPs in particular, who wanted to hold the government's feet to the fire, and rightly so, as well as backbench Conservative MPs. It also meant that basically until there was a lot of pressure, until later on in COVID, that there was a kind of a demand from all sides of the House that I think it probably was particularly driven by Conservative backbenchers, that there should be votes on the floor of the House to essentially show the House's support for what the government wished to do. And there was a thing called the COVID Recovery Group in the Conservative Party that I think had around 100 plus MPs in it.
And were you in that?
I was in it. At that stage, to be honest with you, I was in it because I was kind of intrigued what's going on, what the debate discussion is. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a biologist. I wasn't a medical professional, so I was just looking for any and all evidence to understand the quite enormous decisions before us. I was also in a conflicted situation where quite early on into my parliamentary career, I was made a what we call the PPS, that we've done an episode on, Parliamentary Private Secretary, which essentially means you're on the payroll and therefore expected to kind of just take the government line. And there was one particular time when we were voting on Plan B. This is coming right towards the end of the COVID regulations. And it was contentious. It got 100 Conservative MPs voted against in the end. But there was two PPSs, one of whom is now a minister. I won't say who.
Oh.
But there were two PPSs, one of whom was a minister, and myself, were called to Downing Street one-to-one because we were the only ones on the payroll who were talking about resigning as a PPS in order to vote against the government. And in fact, that one of those individuals has told that individual, the other individual has told me that it's their biggest regret that they didn't end up voting against that in their parliamentary career.
They're now a minister.
They're now a minister. So what happened was, because there was a lot of chatter about ministers could go, Downing Street didn't want us to come down Downing Street and be seen by the lobby and photographed and videoed. So we got a call inviting us, but we had to go through number 70 Whitehall, which, as you know, James, is the Cabinet Office.
Mm-hmm.
So going to the Cabinet Office, and I've never been through this way, and I assume therefore I was meeting in the Cabinet Office. Well, next thing you know, I'm being shown through winding corridors suddenly to this one of those doors that slide shut behind you or in your tube and then let you through.
The one that goes through from 70 to
Downing Street. And indeed, and connected, and didn't know it existed, connected the Cabinet Office to Downing Street. Mm. And then told to wait in a meeting room, sat there, had a cup of tea, brought through to this room. And for the first time in my life, I was suddenly in the Cabinet room with the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, the Chief Whip, Mark Spencer, and myself. That was it. And I think it's a perfect power play because it's a pretty intimidating environment where you've got to look a Prime Minister and your Chief Whip in the eye. There's no one else in the room, no civil servants, no other advisors, and you're having quite a frank, honest conversation. We're there for about 30 minutes, going back and forth. I hadn't made my mind up, but I said I would come back in 30 minutes. So after I left the room, because I said you'd appreciate that I'm in your house, your space right now. I'm going to want to get back to my office to just mull things over. And in the end, having been reassured, for example, on the fact that this was, I think it was a 4-week or 5-week kind of backup plan if needed, I thought that I could swallow that enough, and that it was a backup plan. I felt that Boris had given me the assurances I need, but it was quite the moment to be sat for the first time in the cabinet room.
So give us this. So I'm sure you won't want to go. I understand you won't necessarily want to go to super detail on private conversations, but give listeners a flavour. So when you have a meeting like this, because they do, they happen regularly.
Not,
yeah, fairly regularly, right? They would have happened over
every piece of legislation. There'll be meetings major with piece. one, two, maybe 20 groups of MPs.
But the Prime Minister will sit down with groups of concerned MPs, and basically he's trying to get them on side.
Yeah.
So how does that meeting play out? That you go in.
So I'm laughing because with that one, Boris being Boris. Oh, Jonathan, how are you? Good to see you. Yeah. Good to see you. Now, come on. What are you doing?
You're just gonna... just to say that impression's not as good as the...
No, it's not as good as Michael's. Michael's. But, oh, come on, Jonathan. You know, let's just get behind this. We're one team. Let's be a team. Let's get behind this. And it was almost like he was saying, it felt like I was coming in the room and it was the courtesy. Slap on the back. Good chap. How are you? We've had a little... You know, good to see each other for 30 seconds, but you know, let's get on with the job.
Let's do it.
And I said, straight away, I was kind of caught off guard because you're in the room with a big personality.
Mm. And the Prime Minister.
And the Prime Minister on top of that. Right. So you're already intimidated because of the room you're in. You're intimidated because it's one-to-one with the Prime Minister. He will have had access to information, data, briefings that I could only imagine. Mm. So there I am with my Google research in front of me. Not Wikipedia, to reassure listeners, but you know, having read different scientific bits and bobs that have been shared with other colleagues, but also having spoken to my local NHS, and you know, we get into the depths of it, we get into the weeds really in those conversations about what the plan would mean, if it's implemented, how long is it for, is that, am I, when it says 4 or 5 weeks, is that in law or is that just me taking the Prime Minister at his word? If it went on longer, would there be requirement for support for certain businesses? So Stoke Ceramics in particular, and other small business owners in hospitality and leisure. So again, going through all those kind of scenarios and essentially then just talking personally about my own personal view, which had been that for a long time, we've been giving a lot of restrictions. We've been telling people how to live their lives. We've had, I think at that stage, I'm pretty sure the vaccine had begun to be rolled out, if I remember correctly. Sorry to listeners if I've run out my timeline. Essentially just saying that, you know, at some stage we're going to have to bite the bullet really, and wrestling with my own sort of probably natural political conscience, which is the state shouldn't really be trying to tell people how and to live their lives, but also understanding that this disease has meant that my own hospital has been swarmed. People have lost their lives. Mm. And I've had those emails from those constituents who are to this day still obviously very upset and very angry about certain things, understandably. So it was difficult because you're battling your own inner views, political views probably, and ideology alongside trying to be practical and realistic with the situation in front of you. But that was it. The Chief Whip just sat there. He didn't sit directly in the eye line, which also made me nervous. Mark was very good at being about three seats down, so he's in the corner of the eye. And I kept finding myself flicking and he's just kind of looking with like a slight menace in his face. That's unfair. Mark's a really nice guy, but he's just looking. And because it was clever, because he was quiet, I was kind of like, oh. And then I think Mark did chime up at the end about the whole classic chat. You know this, Westminster. Jonathan, you've got a big career ahead of you, And they kind of remind you that rebellion will set your opportunities to rise up the ranks of power a little bit. And I never thought I'd be an MP. I certainly didn't think I'd be a minister. So I was a bit more relaxed maybe compared to some others in that regard. Yeah, and that was the chat. So it was half an hour longer than I thought I would get, I suppose. But yeah, I've also done groups. So it was reported, so I can say it. James Cleverly, when it came to the Rwanda bill.
The one that passed.
The one that was just literally in recent weeks. There was one meeting, I think, where there was 50 colleagues in his office. And then there was another one where it was like groups of 20. And the idea was just to sort of hear colleagues' views on different issues and particularly around some of the ideas related to the European Convention of Human Rights and whether or not the UK, whether or not the international law, but then obviously fairly there would be colleagues in the One Nation groups also meeting saying...
But you found yourself, your position's changed. So you were recently part of the rebellion group, if I'm not mistaken, helping collect a number of signatures for amendments on that legislation. You're now the deputy chairman. I assume you voted for the legislation. And so how do you square that circle?
That's a very fair point. So for me, I made the decision at two different stages to not vote against the legislation because I fully supported the principle of the Rwanda deal. I still fully believe that Rwanda is going to be an effective deterrent. I had a number of amendments that I wanted to see changed, but second reading, because that bill at that stage hadn't been amended, I chose to abstain to allow the bill to go through. I knew it had the votes from our side and therefore felt, but I didn't want to put my name onto it yet. And then I also, and then at third reading, we hadn't been successful with some amendments. So again, I chose to abstain because I said that I wanted to see legislation toughened up because I think this is where nuance sometimes can get lost. There was never a disagreement with Rwanda. There's never been a disagreement about Rwanda, the deterrent. There's never been a disagreement on 98% of that bill. The specific discussion I was having with the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary and a number of my own colleagues was the whether or not international law should be regarded in the same way that we regard the laws that we pass in the House of Parliament.
Parliamentary
sovereignty, as it's called. Mm. And in my view was that on matters related to our borders and for our security and for why I voted for Brexit back in 2016, it was not the case that the European Court of Human Rights should be able to interject and therefore frustrate the process, and that simply all I wanted to do was reverse what the kind of bill had said, which is I wanted the bill to say we will automatically ignore the ECHR and in some exceptions accept its judgment, whereas in the bill says we'll accept some judgments, but we have the reserve power to ignore it if and so we wish. And the Prime Minister has been very clear on a number of occasions, well before appointing me as his Deputy Chairman of the Conservative Party, that he is going to ignore any interference of any foreign court. And therefore, that gives me full confidence, which is why, yes, I voted against every amendment from the House of Lords and the Labour Party, and I fully support the legislation because the legislation as it is will get flights off, and therefore I think will have the deterrent effect, and the Prime Minister is willing to stand up on the international court situation. But yeah, you're right. That would have been, I mean, look, it was well documented that there was one morning when the new Conservatives were invited into Downing Street. A group of, I think, about 20 of us on that day went to Downing Street to meet the Prime Minister on the day of the vote at second reading. It was reported that we had, some sort of salmon or prawns. Mm. Like that. We didn't. It was bacon rolls or croissants.
The media getting it wrong again.
The media getting it wrong
this
again.
This is the old media.
The old media. This is why we need new media like this. So that was quite a big moment because we're walking as a group. You've got an awful lot of journalists sat outside who had been briefed about the fact this meeting was taking place. Because at that stage, it wasn't abundantly clear whether or not the Prime Minister was going to get the second reading through. So we go into the cabinet room. We're sat there again. So that's quite a cool moment. We're at the cabinet table. The Prime Minister walks in. You can imagine that I would say it was a frostier affair because obviously the Prime Minister has put an awful lot of his own stake on this piece of legislation, put an awful lot of his own time into his legislation. His team had worked tremendously hard on it. I've had a number of conversations with his team before the bill was even drafted about what I'd hope or like to see in it. And understandably, he was frustrated because the morning was all about whether or not the bill would even pass rather than what he wanted, which is what any Prime Minister and leader of a party should want, which is, this bill's going through, now what's the opposition going to do? Mm. It was distracting from the opposition. And it was a tense meeting. It was very frank. Obviously, respect that I'm not going to go into detail. Mm. But it was very frank, very open conversation. Views were exchanged firmly but fairly from both sides. And I think the overwhelming majority of those colleagues in the room backed him at second reading on the promise that they would obviously look at the amendments. And to be fair, they did look at the amendments. We just couldn't sadly get the agreement that we thought we'd all compromise that maybe both sides would have liked. But yeah, that's probably been the toughest one I've been in. Mm. Because at that time in particular, you just know how important this piece of legislation is. You know that the Prime Minister's put a lot of his own personal stake in it. And quite frankly, you're aware of potentially unintended consequences that could have come from potentially bringing that bill down. So that was probably the toughest one I've been in to date. Other colleagues may have other ones that they've done. you know, the renters reform bill that's going through the House at the moment. It's reported, don't know if it's true, it's reported that one colleague has advised colleagues to vote against it a third reading, and therefore that piece of legislation may or may not at
You'll
this
probably
stage.
Know. I remember my, I guess the kind of equivalent when, for a lot of the time that I was a special advisor, was Brexit.
That would have been a crazy time.
So so working for Michael Gove at the time, we'd obviously speak to Ollie Robbins, the chief negotiator, a bit. It was kind of an update, and also Michael to share views. But we did go in a couple of times to see the PM, Theresa May then. I remember a couple of them, but I remember one, as you said, so I can't remember the specific, there was a big, as we've seen a discussion again recently about some of the issues you've touched on with the Good Friday Agreement. How would this affect the Good Friday Agreement? So criticism of part of the changes some people wanted on the kind of the Brexit side, if you like, of the debate. The criticism was that it would impact the Good Friday Agreement. And so I think Michael was curious, I didn't speak for him, I think it was relatively well documented at the time. Michael was curious to understand the deal and the nature and whether that was the case and discuss that. So we had to go in. But my abiding memory, despite obviously being a very serious discussion, is from a special advisor, or someone working for the MP, how those go along. So we were told the PM wanted to see Michael. We didn't know if we'd be allowed in the meeting. So we decided best thing is to do, just get in the ministerial car. They're going to let it into Downing Street, walk in. And I just said, well, we'll just keep going until they stop us, right?
Classic you.
And they didn't stop us. So we ended up in the room with the PM. And I remember, better dressed these days. I had a pair of Nike Air Max that had rainbows down the side. And I just remember seeing Theresa May kind of look down at my trainers, probably thinking, what on earth do you think you're doing? Walking up to the PM's office in a pair of rainbow-coloured trainers. But there were tense meetings because there were, you know, tough issues that are kicked around by, you know, that was Theresa's deal. Michael had concerns about it. And, you know, they're quite tense
I'm assuming from those meetings as well, Michael would have had a lot of pressure. Having been what sort of the co-leader of the Leave campaign, there would have been the European Research Group wanting to meet to hear his views. He would have had other outside pressures from, again, people who are quite senior figures in the Vote Leave campaign. Mm. I'm assuming...
Very to anyone in particular.
I'm assuming that those kind of discussions were going on quite regularly, as well as obviously with other cabinet colleagues who were pro the Brexit cause and were sort of checking with each other about whether or not the deal was at the place it should be.
I think, I can't speak for Michael. I don't speak for him anymore. My own view is I always felt Michael got an unfair rap from some of the Leave crowd because the problem was at the time, it was impossible to see how a deal got through Parliament. That's your problem number one. The other problem is, and I can say this, I'm not part of government, David Cameron and George Osborne had purposely done absolutely no preparation for a no-deal Brexit. So they'd just assumed that Remain would win or frankly, I don't think cared if it didn't because they weren't going to be there. And then, you know, various departments, you know, Michael came in, not immediately with Theresa, came in about a year afterwards, I think. And so there wasn't the no-deal readiness that there should have been. Obviously something that, you know, Dom Cummings really went for to get the negotiation across the line at the end. I think one of his tenets of his plan was to say, we are going to go hell for leather for no deal because it's a negotiating position. So the other side, no, you can't do it. You've got something off the table. So though in that kind of mix of issues, I think I always felt that Michael was willing to listen to a range of ideas but to get the best deal to ensure we got Brexit. And the purists who were on the back benches, they didn't, you know, they could just say no to things and it didn't really matter what happened, would say, oh, he's kind of selling out. That's completely not true. What he was looking for is what's the best road ahead. And it doesn't mean he agreed with all those ideas. He was just willing to listen to different ideas.
Also in a parliament that has no Conservative majority.
There was no Conservative majority. And frankly, as we know, it took an election that Boris had to break through that. Boris and Dom coming in, there was no majority for any deal because we did meaningful votes. We did the options,
and no one agreed on an option.
No one could agree on an option, and so yeah, that's a lot of what was going on. So there was a lot of meetings. There were meetings with the kind of, you know, again, I won't go into super detail. It's up for those people like Boris and Michael and David Davis, etc., Liam Fox, who were involved to write their own memoirs. But I would end up in, you know, back of rooms of meetings with those kind of Brexiteers in cabinet, with Geoffrey Cox, who was very, very respected by everybody, Geoffrey, I imagine still is. And yeah, they were difficult meetings because often you were trying to have those meetings in private and inevitably they would leak and someone would put their own spin on what happened in that meeting, and invariably no one's spin was true. It was their own view of what happened, and that was what was going on in cabinet every week. I mean, I think people forget, like, you now don't really read about what happens in cabinet.
It became a running joke from an outsider's perspective that you'd find out what was discussed in cabinet within a matter of hours after the cabinet meeting.
There was one special advisor who had essentially had a broadcast list of the whole lobby and would just broadcast their spin of cabinet out within within hours. So that was all very tricky. But that is some of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And I think it's reflective, and it shows, I think there's a, you know, that still obviously goes on, yeah, but in different ways. And so, you know, on that, but that goes on across things. So on workings of Parliament, I thought the other, you know, you've been on a couple of select committees, yeah, now.
Education, our business and trade.
And so kind of less secretive and maybe kind of less gossipy, if you like, kind of less newsworthy, but going on the dailies of Parliament. On those kinds of things, a lot of people only really, I think the public only see select committees when you've got an evidence session, and probably then when it's with a kind of, you've sat on the recent ones on business with the postmaster scandal.
So the post office obviously had a lot of tension because obviously of what, the, you know, on the...
There's a lot of prep goes into that.
But a lot of prep goes into that. So you get the, yeah, so what would happen with a select committee is you'll get... People forget that we have essentially civil servants who support the select committee hired by the Houses of Parliament. We have clerks, legal advice, researchers, the works.
To give us a quick structure of a select committee, so you've got the MPs, we've done a bit on select committees.
You have like a chief clerk who's basically the main
only civil, works for that select committee.
Who only works for that particular select committee and is basically, imagine, the permanent secretary of that, right, of that select committee. Then I think you have one deputy, maybe a couple, and then you've essentially just got a load of researchers. You'll have some people who will deal with the media. You have some people who deal with the witnesses, some other people who help draft the questions, some other people who take down
all the minutes,
all the notes. I think so. You have people who take down all the notes, minutes of all the meetings, publish them, etc., help draft the correspondence on behalf of the committee, normally done in the chair's name, but with the committee's kind of blessing. And, you know, it's a lot of work goes into it. So, yeah, with the recent stuff around the post office, you know, we've had huge documents sent to us and was made even more difficult because we had to be briefed with the fact that there is a legal inquiry currently going on into it about what things we can and cannot discuss.
So we'll be very careful now.
So we have to be very careful
now.
So
you don't need to go into detail now.
No, we're not going into detail. But workings. I mean, what I mean by that is that, you know, getting the legal briefing and then, of course, understanding what we can and can't say and actually having to require the inquiry to give us permission to even do the evidence sessions.
Right.
Knowing that could, those evidence sessions could well be used as part of this legal inquiry.
And go back into the inquiry.
And go back into it, depending on what's said. So there's an awful lot of that.
You get strong legal advice.
Very strong legal advice.
You know where the lines are.
And the clerks and that lot are ready in case you, and it would genuinely be inadvertently overstep the mark. Because MPs know how serious these things are. So you get your briefing pack with something like that, hundreds of pages.
Right.
And you're reading through, and the committee does, normally in these packs, you'll have the questions at the front into sections, normally also done by panel. So when I say by panel, you might have, as we have done, we've had three or four panels on one day in order to chunk up the different witnesses, in order to allow each witness more time to talk. Obviously, if you had 20 people at once, you'd never have a proper interaction or discussion. And then what they do is they chunk into those sections, then replicated, but in more detail. So news reportings, questions that have been answered in the chamber or written questions that have been answered by ministers, as well as any evidence that's been provided that is now publicly available. And that's kind of all there. And we read through all that. And then essentially what happens in select committees is you have a thing called the private meeting first. Those private meetings are normally half an hour, 15 minutes to half an hour before the public session, before things go on the public record. That's where we discuss and debate whether or not we should publish correspondence sent by the chair or received by the committee to make sure they're publicised. Then we'll normally talk about maybe if we're going to engage with any foreign national governments who are over here, or any witnesses that we'd like to investigate, or even just debate the programme itself, the Ford programme. What is it we want to focus on, spend our time doing and inquiring about? And then finally you come to chunking up the questions. And that's when MPs will pitch. Normally the chair will kind of open the floor and say, are there people who want particular questions?
Chair gets his pick though, right?
The chair, each chair does their own thing.
Okay.
So Robert Halfon always liked to just go through his questions at the beginning, and then he'd basically just leave it to other colleagues and choose. Liam Byrne likes to open up with the first question and then maybe have a couple of follow-ups, and then again kind of chunks in and says he reserves the right to sort of chip in at the end of a section for each MP.
They have stylistic differences.
So I think Darren Jones, again, was a bit the same as Liam, kind of came in at the beginning and then would go in from there. And it's very conciliatory. Look, you'll get some colleagues go, well, I want number four and so do I. And then someone will go, well, you know, Douglas Chapman, SNP, I'll go, Douglas, you take it. But can I come in with an additional? And Liam goes, yeah, fine. And they just make a note of that, which is how Liam knows who to direct the questions to. So it looks like it's much more of a smoother process when you're watching it. But you obviously also have WhatsApp groups that you're texting in during sessions going, can I come in quickly here?
Or, oh, really?
Someone should ask this. Or
I've
just
never
said,
even noticed that.
And said that. No, it's normally done, I think, using the laptops, because you can obviously get web WhatsApp or whatever like that. Yeah. So people are typing quickly on there. Or Liam's very good at constantly scouting the room. So normally just the half hand going up to give Liam a little wave. And then he normally goes, for me, like he does the symbol of, you're going to be brief, aren't you, Jonathan?
He knows you too well already.
He knows me too well already. So yeah, that's, and then obviously those sessions, and then we normally kind of, we'll chat in the WhatsApp group afterwards, what we thought of it, anything interesting in particular came out of it. And then at the next session, we might go, oh, there might be more questions. I mean, not to go into specifics, but obviously, in our last one, some witnesses, for the first time in my entire parliamentary career, I saw witnesses put under oath speaking to the committee, all related to the post office. So the CEO of the post office and others.
For the committee?
No, before the committee. They were made to swear an oath, which is therefore legally binding. And if you are found to, basically you could have been found guilty in contempt of parliament, which, as you know, is very serious indeed.
Interesting.
And one of the questions that was posted to one of the to Nick Reed was, have you ever considered resigning? He said no. I think the chair asked that question. And then the next witness claimed that he, in fact, had done, and that allegedly, and I make that word importantly, allegedly, there is a trail of evidence that suggests he did. Now,
we'll see.
Let's see. But what I'm saying is, in those situations, it would then be a discussion for the committee whether or not to pursue, if evidence was uncovered, whether or not a contempt of parliament had indeed taken place. Now, that would, you know, that I think that would, that's the only thing I've probably got left to do. I've seen everything else in parliament, but those are the type of very serious things that are going on. So that's a select committee really working. And like you say, and most importantly, select committees are cross-party. So Liam is a Labour MP. He's also the chair. As we've heard from other podcasts, the incoming government gets to select which ones they would want chairs of, and then the rest are divvied up between Labour and then the third largest party, who obviously the SNP are the chairs of the Scottish Affairs Select Committee. And members, the balance is normally that if you've got, I think, the balances are worked out on the political numbers on each committee. And again, for listeners, to be a member of a committee, if there's more than one person putting their name forward for a vacancy, there will literally be an election. But if it's a Conservative vacancy, only Conservative MPs can vote for it. If it's a Labour vacancy, only Labour MPs can vote for it. But for the chairs of select committees, you put nominations forward, you have to, and then all MPs across the House will vote on the chair of a select committee. So that's how it differs there. And
so let me ask you this, so all taken in the round, we've touched on some of the things during COVID and Brexit. I wonder, you know, the stuff that goes on in the background, because the whole point when we set this up, Jonathan, is to kind of understand some of the things that are maybe not in the news, or understand some of the things that are in the news a bit better. And so we see these things covered. We see the meetings that you had with Rishi as Prime Minister on the Rwanda bill, maybe not your specific meetings, but some of the meetings that happened during COVID with Boris and the relevant secretaries of state, kind of know they happen. How important are they? Do you think they work well? Do you think they help Parliament work better, help government work better? You know, are they useful things? Could it work in a better way?
I think it's so important to have those conversations and discussions. I think that for any leader of any party or any secretary of state over any department, reality is there are going to be colleagues on your own side as well as the opposition benches who may have difference of opinion or believe that things can be worked in a different way. And the best way to keep things out of newspapers and the best way to avoid fights on the floor of the House, verbally, that is, or to best way to avoid votes, or the best way to have your own colleagues not vote against is by regular open dialogue. I think nearly all MPs are aware you can't have your cake and eat it. There's going to have to be some compromise. You're going to have to pick and choose what hills you are and are not willing to die on. There are some things that I've signed amendments-wise that haven't gone to a vote. I've still voted for the bill because I still agree with the overall principle of the bill, and we're talking about 1 or 2% difference. And at the end of the day, it's my responsibility to my constituents to think about the overall bigger picture and not trying to be a political purist at the best of times. Mm. And so I think that's where those conversations can take a lot of heat out of debate, can mean that the government retains its messaging.
Because we touched on this with Nigel Evans, and I really enjoyed that episode, really enjoyed talking to Nigel. And one of the things that we discussed with him that kind of struck me is Parliament's actual geography, how Parliament is set up and how that affects the workings of Parliament and the tea rooms.
Yeah.
So take us into the tea rooms briefly, because, as far as you're allowed to. But Nigel talks about things like, you know, the dining room in the evening when there's maybe late votes. You had late votes.
Yeah, yeah.
Documented, I don't know if you went to it. I spoke to someone else who did go to the drinks in the Prime Minister's room.
Yes, there was, we were grouped up, I think.
Are you grouped up?
I went to one of the earlier sessions when the nibbles hadn't been fully touched, and I definitely over-devoured on the nibbles.
What was it, smoked salmon or bacon?
Chris, and then there was some, that chorizo with like spicy cheese, like the chorizo wrapped around it from M&S. I definitely had way too many of them. Gareth Davies, I'm going to name him and shame him as well, but he's in much better shape than me. We were stood by them and we were both realizing that we were like every other word. I think we were almost like grabbing some.
MPs who'd listened to this and came to later sessions and there wasn't any food, they
could blame me. Gareth. Blame me. Don't, poor Gareth. He's a good guy.
They'll blame you anyway, so you're fine on that one. But those kinds of things, are they important to the work in the Parliament?
So those things are soft power, right? Those things are the human touch, the human element, just actually allowing colleagues to spend a bit of time with one another, to allow the Prime Minister or the leader of any party to interact with their own MPs. And because obviously the guy's busy, right? He's had that vote. The next day he's flying to Poland. Now he's in Germany. Mm. So it's not as if you have an abundance of time to spend with the Prime Minister at the best of times with his inbox. So those moments are important for just morale. They're important for creating a sort of team environment and quite frankly, to just have those casual chats. And so, you know, Rishi would ask how my kids are, how's Nikita? I shouldn't have probably named her, I'll get in trouble for that naming it now. Poor woman. How's Nikita? He knows that he has got an incredible memory. I must confess, he's like, how's she doing in teaching?
I've spoken to him for a while, but last time I spoke to him, he was the same with me. He's like, so mine and his daughters are exactly the same age. In fact, his eldest, because my eldest is having a birthday this weekend, his eldest birthday must be this month, because it's the same month. But he kind of came up and was like, oh, how are the girls? Because we've both got girls.
He throws you, right?
Yeah.
You don't think he's got that ability to how he's remembering
he
all that?
He does have a very good memory for that stuff.
Would you be any good at that? I'd be rubbish at that. I'd have to have someone whispering in my ear.
I'm terrible with names. I'm quite good at remembering most other things, like things about people, but terrible with names. Michael was insane with names. You meet people he hasn't met for 5 years, but oh, hello, Martin. I'd be like, oh, how the hell? I've met them 5 times. I can't remember the name. I want to go back to the team room quickly because I'm curious. So
they're talked about, aren't they?
They're talked about. We always hear about
it. And nowadays, when a prime minister goes to a tea room, it makes news.
So tell me this, where is the tea room? What does it look like? Is it for all parties? Is it big tables? What is the tea room?
The tea room is situated kind of in between the chamber and the library, either side. Okay. And then another end, you'll have the Speaker's office and eventually central lobby. Right. So it's kind of situated okay. in and around that area.
So is there anyone that knows Parliament?
There are ends to it. So the far end, not where the food or the tills are instantly. The far end is where the Conservatives go.
Is that on the right-hand side?
Oh,
I was going to say, is maybe. It on the far right?
It depends. Very good. Very good. So you've got those at the far end. But in the centre, you'll have also the Lib Dems have, I think it depends on size. The SNP have got a couple of tables that are kind of settly theirs.
So you know
Lib Dems have a table. The DUP have a table.
So you wouldn't go and sit at a quote SNP Lib Dem table?
Not unless it's free. You could do, but like everyone does stick to the... It's amazing how okay. human nature is, honestly. And then the end where you enter normally, which is where the tills are and the food are, is the Labour end, essentially. Now, right. I asked, is it always like that? Because there's more space up where we are. Mm. So I said, is that because we're the party government, large party? But apparently not.
Oh, right.
Now, who knows? Going forward, but apparently not, because you would not fit. You could probably fit 50, maybe 50, 60 MPs, Conservative MPs around the tables, but there'll be no chairs left after that. But it's quite weirdly good at self-regulating how busy it is. I've never struggled to find a seat.
Right, but there's normally a few people.
But there's normally a lot. Yeah,
if you went up there right now, would there be?
So they're probably about at this time.
Four o'clock in the afternoon.
You probably get about three or probably about five, probably ten, because we've got votes coming up later and stuff like that. So
everyone in there will
get busier as the closer to votes we get. Okay. People leave their offices, they go there for a cup of tea before the votes, or they'll have one during votes or in between votes. Maybe grab a bit of dinner if it's like 5-6. So that's when it starts to get busier.
And only MPs are allowed in
there? And members of the House of Lords.
Okay.
So you have to Lords have got their own kind of tea room. And it is... I tend to see a lot more Labour Lords going in the tea rooms who are ex-MPs than I do Conservatives. But I think it's also a bit like you're allowed in, but at the end of the day, this is for MPs. So if it's getting busy, I think the Lords are expected to be in their own tea room just to kind of free up the space. They've got their own place. But yeah, that's where you've got... So the tea room is, literally only MPs. So the people who work, the chef, does a cracking bit of cheese on toast, I must say. the ladies who make the tea, the coffee, or Godfrey. I'm going to give Godfrey a big shout out because he knows... He's got like a Michael-sized memory of knowing everyone's name and remembering bits of information about them. And always cheery, even at like midnight when everyone's like just wanting to go to bed. He's always fantastic. So those are probably some of the most powerful people because they'll be milling around and will hear everything.
So do cabinet ministers go in there?
So I've heard different things. So I was told that David Cameron used to try quite regularly go in the tea room to have his lunch after PMQs.
I heard he did this almost every week. Yeah.
Almost every week. Under, obviously, COVID, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
In recent years, I would say it's rare to see the Prime Minister. It now is kind of like seen, to be quite frank, as either Rishi was in there the other night when we were voting late because we're there till late. He was at the house anyway. He just, stretched his legs.
But it's seen as a thing to
report. But it's now seen as a thing. And it's now been reported when Boris, before we started to see colleagues resigning from various payroll positions, Boris had visited the tea rooms, and that was put in the news as like trying to shore up support and woo colleagues over. Yeah. And I think it's a shame it sounds like that, because I think the Cameron idea should be that case, because again, you get such a little chance to have just face to face. And I will say Rishi has done a number of times now, probably a handful, come around the tea rooms. His PPS Craig Williams is guiding from table to table to make sure he has spoken to every table and spoken to as many colleagues as possible. Just say a friendly hello. And I think that's good. And in those moments, you tend to see the cabinet in there as well. Sometimes maybe a cabinet minister per table. It's almost as if that was perfectly planned.
Really?
But you'll see that as well. But some ministers are generally very good. I remember being advised by Therese Coffey when I was appointed as a minister in the Department for Education. Definitely Wednesday morning, go over there, have your breakfast there and sit around for a bit. Because if colleagues see you, they might want to grab you. Sometimes they want a photo to say that they've met with you. Sometimes they want a very specific thing, but it shows willingness to, you've got a nice office in your department, but actually your bread and butter is your parliamentarian. Mm. And your job is to make sure that to make your life easier as a minister, it's good to keep your colleagues on side and be available to your colleagues as much as possible, which is why you'll hear these things called tea room surgeries that you have had to prep Pretty and Michael for, which would have driven you probably mad at times.
I was set outside them,
because you wouldn't have been allowed in the tea rooms. Normally her PPS would have been in there, but that's when you get, again, colleagues for like an hour slot, they get 5 minutes each and they want to rant about a very specific particular
normally
issue.
You just have all these prep meetings which are like, oh, we've got 10 people coming to the tea room surgery. And I mean, the issues...
I feel like, James, you didn't take these tea room surgeries very seriously, it sounds like. I can imagine you would have been quite begrudging, dismissive.
I don't know if it's that.
Maybe even slightly rude about the fact that Pretty or Michael's going to have to spend time with their colleagues at times.
It was the level of some of the issues sometimes. I felt they were... I didn't necessarily like feel that the issue was worth raising or whatever. I don't know how to put it, but they seemed...
Someone comes in with something very vague and just broad, which is like, you would already know this because you're in the department, or other things are like, there's obviously junior ministers with portfolios and actually that could have been picked up by junior ministers.
You probably won't like this. There's a load of things that MPs probably have to do to get elected, stay elected. And we see it when you post a video of PMQs or oral questions.
A 2 minute PMQ that
it's kind of raising something for the sake of raising it. So those things I find about politics slightly frustrating, because if, you know, particularly in DEFRA, we'd have people with campaigns, specific things that you might agree with or you might not agree with, but they were genuinely trying to change, you know, the law or get you to do something as a department, a policy thing. And it was, you know, for their constituency or an issue they were passionate about. That didn't bother me at all, because, you know, they were often quite interesting, or, you know, you could understand why they were doing them. The kind of raising things for the sake of raising something, to say, I have raised this, that is just like a part of modern day politics or politics that I think I find frustrating, because it's just part of like playing the game. And then so kind of then sometimes, and tea room surgeries have an air of that about them, as does some parts of oral questions and so on. But I find
it might shock you when you offer the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, as I did, the opportunity to have tea room surgery with colleagues. Sadly, you wouldn't get the take up that required to have a tea room surgery.
Really?
I would suggest your tea room surgeries get booked out hard and fast if Home Office, Education,
Environment,
Health,
Environment does.
DEFRA will, absolutely. But I think best ones for Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, DCMS or Culture, Media, Sport, Science and Technology, sorry Saqib if you're listening, they won't necessarily have the same vigour for being booked up.
But the, I guess you're not going to go into it, but I'm going to try and get you to anyway. There must be a lot of gossip that goes on in the tea room.
The tea room is somewhere that I would suggest is one of the only places that you're probably able to have frank conversation.
Mm.
I say this weirdly without worrying about it leaking, but you're with a bunch of MPs. But bizarrely, I must confess, I can't really remember many cases, if any, in fact, where I've seen a conversation that I've been party to, which even I've thought, oof, if that got out in the media, you know, that could easily be a news story, has ever actually been published.
So that's respected.
It's almost, MPs. I would suggest, respected. Mm. I think there's the odd thing, but I can't really think of much.
I would suggest your WhatsApp groups aren't respected in the same way, because I seem
certainly
to read
not.
Sam Coates or whoever coming out with a WhatsApp group.
There's a running joke that Sam Coates must be in one of the WhatsApp groups, because colleagues keep wondering how he seems.
But that's interesting. So the tea room is actually like...
probably one of the only safest places.
So you feel as an MP, I can go up to whoever, say something that I want to get off my chest, and that's...
Look, I've been told during the Brexit days, some colleagues... some former colleagues of ours, some of whom indeed went on to lose the whip under Boris Johnson, would go in the chamber and, you know, do everything they could to stop Brexit from happening, then come in the tea room and sit down at tables with their colleagues as if nothing was wrong. And colleagues were like, how dare you sit at the table with us? You've literally just caused utter chaos in this place.
Really?
Go sit, you know, it was really frosty. I was told that heated exchanges, shouting, stuff like that could take place.
But they didn't get out.
Didn't seem to get out. I've never personally seen... I've seen, look, frank and what could be verging on to quite a heated debate and discussion or temperature amongst colleagues, but I've never seen anything that I, you know, that would personally worry me. It's always quite jokey. In fact, it's probably where after PMQs you have a good laugh with like your Labour colleagues. I've had many good laughs about who we think we got the best line in on that day, or like my own PMQ recently. I'm glad you've only just finished after, you know, I think I've now set the record for longest PMQ.
Lengthy one.
So, you know, I think those type of discussions. And the speaker also is very good. This speaker, I don't know about previous speakers, but this speaker definitely has breakfast every morning in the tea room.
Oh, right, okay.
And so colleagues go up sometime. I've sat down with him quite regularly at his own table and caught up with him and, you know, just had a good chat.
So if you want to know the temperature of the house, this sounds like the best
place.
If you're an MP or...
The tea room is definitely the place to get the temperature and the vibe.
Or MP.
If you were a good PPS, and I generally say Craig Williams, who's Rishi's PPS, is one of the best ones. He is... Even if it's just a flyby, as I would call it, a walk-in, three-minuter and out, he regularly will appear.
Yeah.
I think the best ones I saw, Alex Burkhart was very good at that when he was PPS to Boris as well. But the best ones I've seen are that they hang around the tea rooms.
Interesting.
And they're hearing the conversation. They can feed that into the centre and get a gauge and a vibe. But I would certainly suggest for any leader of any party, and actually I must say, I haven't seen Keir Starmer in the tea rooms much, if at all.
Oh, really?
Now, I doesn't say he hasn't done, but, you know, he might just go in a different time. I think it's very foolish for any leader of any party to not spend time in those tea rooms. And even if it's half an hour at your diary and you're tired and you tell the PMQs or whatever, I think trying to find time once a week just to pop your head in, it's good for morale. It's good for keeping colleagues felt that they're engaged and important. And it would buys you an awful lot of goodwill on the parliamentary benches.
That's great. So we're off to the tea room now.
You are not allowed in. You are not allowed in. The only other thing I would say about this place and behind the scenes working is there are things that call it, if people look at the order paper, as we would call it, there's a thing called, there's always department questions, ministerial statements or urgent questions.
That was a fascinating episode. So thanks so much for that, Jonathan.
Well, thank you as well.
We learned a lot, mainly that I would really love to get into that tea room. But I don't think I'm going to tell you something soon.
The problem is special advisors are known to talk to members of the lobby. And so I think it's always good to keep special advisors out. As you say, advisors advise.
Oh, yeah, because MPs are so well known for not speaking to members
of the
lobby.
Well, as I could tell you, James, the tea room is a sort of a sacred room where conversations...
And how's the WhatsApp groups going?
WhatsApp groups...
Because there ain't no special advisors on them.
Sometimes you wonder if there is.
You might,
depends if your principal hands the phone over or not, I suppose.
You need to look a little closer to home, I think, with your colleagues on that one, I suspect.
That is very fair. I'll accept that charge.
If you're going to come back. But I thought it was really interesting. I think we'll take a dive more into some of the kind of 10-minute warble stuff in another episode. And we are hopefully going to have a chair of a select committee soon, which will be...
Fascinating.
Go more into detail of that. But that was great. Thanks for today. So thanks from me, James Starkey.
And thank you from me, Jonathan Gullis. And of course, we always want you to leave us a rating and a review. So make sure that you do that. Make sure however it is that you listen to your podcast, you hit that important subscribe button so you don't ever miss out on an episode as and when we release them. And of course, you can still follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @WhitehillPodUK.